The following program is brought to you by Total Theater Online. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the staff or management of WGBB. You're listening to the station that serves your community, 1240 WGBB. And now it's time for Dave's Gone By with David Lefkowitz.
Well, there goes the neighborhood. Welcome, everybody, to Dave's Gone By on this March 24th, 2005, our 120th episode. That's right. We have fulfilled the Jewish life wish, so appropriate for the evening that begins Purim. What Jew doesn't say, you should live to 120. And we've done it. This program has lived to 120, and it's not even on a respirator or gumming its food. Now, unfortunately, it's not the hippest program in the world, so it has been considering a hip replacement, which is not uncommon for a show that has lived this long, and it has written out a living will, saying that if the show ever does one of these three things, it's authorized me to pull the plug on the mini-disc. I have the will in front of me. Here it is. The last will and testing 1, 2, 3 of this show. It reads, I, Dave's Gone By, being of unsound mind for a body of work, to hereby authorize my producer and host, Dave Lefkowitz, to take the following steps should I no longer be able to function as a weekly comedy, talk, and music show. Should I slip into a senescent state, which would be evidenced by such actions taken as A, changing the opening greeting from There Goes the Neighborhood to Hello, this is Dan Rather with the news, B, retiring the weekly segment Inside Broadway and replacing it with Inside the Crimean War, Winter, 1855. C, changing the title of my book, Marriage, Babies, and the End of the World, to Unidentified Rectangular Object with Pages in It. D, identifying this radio station as AM 1240 WG, what year is this? And E, actually sounding like a slick professional radio show. Should any of these sad events occur, Dave Lefkowitz has power of attorney to eject Dave's Gone By from life support, to thoroughly degauss it, and to bury it next to unaired episodes of 21st Century Music. No steps should be taken to revive it by digital manipulation, infusion of guest stars, or inclusion of cheap stunts like silly contests, phony phone calls, strippers, and or midgets. The time slot currently... Sorry. There's a codicil on the bottom saying it has second thoughts about that clause and that midgets and or strippers can stay, especially strippers. Okay, so some cheap and vulgar tactics may be employed to revive the program. However, if any music by Bon Jovi, Kenny G, or Jefferson Starship is ever played on the show, that is automatic grounds for euthanasia. The time slot currently held by Dave's Gone By should be preserved for reruns of the show in its prime, or, barring that, donating the infomercials for Dave's favorite charity, the Foundation for Cruelly Imitating the Retarded When They're Not Looking. I, Dave's Gone By, hereby vouch that this document was fully approved by me, and that my signature on the bottom makes this a legal, binding contract throughout the Bahamas, Ecuador, and Lower Malaysia. Wait a minute. Bahamas, Ecuador, and Malaysia. Oh, God damn these cut-rate internet lawyers. I knew there was a catch when the guy volunteered to draft the will in exchange for a forged green card and two bottles of Johnny Walker Red. Oh, well. I guess the show will have to keep going as it is, indefinitely, past the 120 mark, maybe past the 920 mark. Give Methuselah a run for his Methuselah. And that's fine by me, because Dave's Gone By may be 120 shows old, but to me it still feels like a brand new adventure every week. It really does. I mean, sometimes in the winter, I don't want to schlep to the station all that much, or I'll get busy with other things, and then start to feel pressure from the deadline of putting out a show every week. Not one show, but two these days, since I'm also doing the music program Filler Up Thursdays at 9. And there are weeks when I worry that I'm not putting the time and effort into the show that I want to, because I have a magazine to edit, or I have theater reviews to write. But for the most part, this show is a joy for me. Something I don't mind putting my energy into. It gives me a voice. It gives me a persona in the entertainment world from a limited perspective, admittedly. and it gives me the chance to engage in an hour of smart talk, silly talk, special talk, and music. I do it every Thursday night at 7 on WGBB, plus you can hear older episodes of the show at 8 and 11 by going to my website, davesgoneby.com, and following the link to DFSX Radio on Live 365. But more on that later. Most importantly, tonight, so much fun stuff. First of all, I have another guest with a really interesting story to share. You know, famous guests are great, and they're exciting, but anybody with a tale worth telling can make for a compelling radio. And I know that'll go for my guest tonight, Larry Quatchy. I mentioned him briefly in a Dave's Day segment a few weeks back. I was at a radio convention. All these authors and inventors were at this big conference in Midtown Manhattan, pitching their books and ideas to people from the media, CNN, The Tony Danza Show, NPR, and me. And mostly you're fending off diet books or living wills or self-help positive affirmation handbooks. And I was disappointed because nobody there was writing about the arts, and there weren't even many literary authors or novelists. But I did meet Larry Quatchy, Quacci, author of the memoir, A Very Good Year. It's his own story, a true story, of his teenage years growing up on Long Island, with a difficult, even abusive father and a mother dying of cancer. That doesn't sound like a barrel of laughs, but it's a lively, often funny, honest and fast-moving book. It also brings up a hot-button issue, because Larry was put in a position when he was 17 years old that even 117-year-olds shouldn't have to cope with. So he's going to tell us all about that and his book, A Very Good Year, later in the program. I'll also be doing a Dave Goes Off segment about the whole parking controversy. These churches in the Bronx are angry that suddenly they have to deal with metered parking on Sundays. And speaking of angry, heaven forbid I should let this Purim go by without a visit from our frequent and controversial but oh so essential guest, Rabbi Sol Solomon. That's all tonight on Dave's Gone By, which, as always, is rated DGB-13 for content unbecoming, and which gets underway with unparalleled parking right after this.
Oh, my God, the wedding is next month. We need flyers, invitations, booklets. Irving, we are screwed.
No, we're not, Pearl. We'll just go to Hewlett Minuteman Press.
Hewlett Minuteman? What can they do?
Printing, engraving.
Really?
Letterhead, souvenirs.
Wonderful. Are they still at 1315 Broadway in Hewlett?
Yup, 516-569-5577.
Well, stop dawdling. Let's go.
Yes, dear. Day after the wedding, I kill her.
Dave goes off. Dave goes off. Dave goes off. Dave goes off.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. Time for a segment called Dave Goes Off. Off on a rampage, off on a tear, off on some speech about things that I'm thinking about. Now, I think the most natural thing would have been for me to talk about all these trials that are going on between Michael Jackson and Robert Blake and Martha Stewart getting out of prison and just one after the other, these high-profile celebrity trials, Lil' Kim, the guy from WorldCom. And yet, because I wasn't at these trials, or even if I'd been watching them on Court TV, which I do not get, I'm not seeing the whole story, so it's very hard for any of us to really weigh in on guilt or innocence or crime and, or punishment or things like that. So I'm sort of sidestepping for the moment, talking about all those things, and going to something a lot lighter and a lot more quality of life. Just going to talk a little bit about parking meters, because apparently that's an issue now, as if it weren't always, that people hate having to pay to park with all the other things that we pay for. But it's become an issue in the Bronx and some other places where churchgoers are complaining that they're putting meters in front of or on the streets where the churches are. So people who come in to go to service on Sundays have to pump a quarter or two into the meter before they go in and you know, go to church. And this isn't so terrible, except for the fact that generally and way too often, the meters don't last long enough for them to simply sit in and go through the service and enjoy it. Either they're going to get a ticket
because they haven't come out to feed the meter fast enough, or they forget, or just don't get out in time, and they do get a ticket, or they have to run out early and pump another quart in the ticket, thus disrupting anybody else in their row. And also, you know how it is when you're sitting somewhere and you know you have money in the meter. Maybe you're in a restaurant or shopping, and you're not totally enjoying it for like the last 20 minutes because you're always looking at your watch. You know you have more than enough time, but you still have that feeling, that urgency, that thing in your gut is like, got to get to the meter. When is it? What time is it? Did I look at my watch right? Did my watch stop? Did I get that quarter or that I don't know if they even bother with dimes anymore. Merchants in the area weren't terribly upset in these high personage areas about the parking meters, because for them, people tend to run in and out, and they want to be able to park, but the merchants don't want them there all day. They want a relatively high turnover, somebody going out in a half hour or an hour, and it allows more people to come in there, park, do their shopping, and go. Because, like, who stays at a hardware store or a grocery more than an hour? But when we're talking about lower density population areas with more sprawl and more churches and places like that, then the merchants aren't even for it, because there's all this aggressive enforcement, and people are forced to dash in and out instead of shopping leisurely. They're not going to take their time, and maybe that extra 5 minutes they would have leisurely strolled around and talked to one of the salesmen, they would have said, no, we're just looking in, we got to get back to the car. And it's not a light thing, because fines for these parking things can go anywhere from $55 to $160 per infringement. And the mayor of Bloomberg is saying that the Sunday meters alone, just on Sundays, generate $7 million for the city, although he has said openly, and that's why it's not even that much of an issue, he has said that he's open to a reprieve for houses of worship, which, that's okay. But I don't know. A couple of things. First of all, if you're sitting in a church for more than 2 hours at a time, I'm sorry, your mind is not going to be on God that whole 120 or so minutes. It's not. You're going to get, in the Yiddish word, spilkes. You'll be thinking about your bladder, about what you're going to have for lunch, what you're going to wear for the week. Maybe, if you're in a different pew, there's a cute divorce guy in another pew that you're looking at. But I'm talking from a woman's point of view, of course. My suggestion is go out and get yourself a guy like that fella in Miami, the parking meter fairy. Have you heard about this? And fairy, I use that in quotes. He was an actor and an artist, a guy named Xavier Cortez, and you probably heard about him or seen him on TV. He's a great visual. He goes around on roller skates and dresses up in a pink curly wig. He wears a lavender tutu and these enormous diaphanous angel wings, which is perhaps not an ideal image for churchgoers to see, but, well, maybe the angel part. But businesses in Miami pay him to go around on skates, and it's worth it for them. They give him a couple of bucks a day to stave off $150 in fines. Why not? He goes, looks at the parking meters. If he sees they're about to be up, about to expire, he'll pump a quarter in, and he's really doing a mitzvah. He's doing a really terrific thing, and the business owners are helping him and paying him and encouraging him. So I say to the deacons and the pastors and the what have yous of all these churches, go do the same thing. Raise a little collection and pay some kid, say $10, to roller skate around with a purse full of quarters that everybody donates, just like the collection plate. And maybe the kid could keep all the quarters he doesn't have to use. Now, apparently, in at least some states, putting money in other people's meters is technically illegal. Now, I have no idea why, but that would put the church in an odd position. So, okay, they might be breaking the law by having this kid do this, but I don't think the law is righteous to begin with. If you want to do a nice thing for somebody and pop a quarter in their meter, what's the government to say no, except for the fact that you're cheating them, so to speak, out of a penalty fine, so instead of the government getting 25 cents, they'd be getting $55 or $100. But as for the question of whether there should be meters to begin with in front of churches and things like that, there is the separation of church and state question, and me being who I am, I also have to say, if there are going to be meters on Saturdays, when Jews go to synagogue, and they have to worry about quarters and meters if they do in their neighborhoods, you know, not the Orthodox who would be walking to shul anyway. But if you're going to charge on Saturdays, well, you ought to charge on Sundays too. If you exempt houses of worship altogether, which would be nice, then do them both, and that would be fine. But also, how about making sure that outside of movie theaters and restaurants, you give people the option to park for at least 3 hours. Maybe they have to pump in $1.50 or something like that or more, but give them the option to go into a long movie or sit down to a big meal at a family-style restaurant or go to all the stores in the strip mall without going nuts over the meter. Well, that's my 2 cents of Dave going off. Want to hear yours? So send them to Dave's Gone By, P.O. Box 62, Hewlett, New York, 11557-0062. That's Box 62 in Hewlett, 11557-0062. Or if you don't want to spend the 25 cents per meter or the 2 cents for a piece of paper and 37 for an envelope, gosh, that's too much math already for me, send me an email. davesgoneby@aol.com. D-A-V as in Victor, E-S, goneby@aol.com. We'll be right back. Dave's Gone By listeners know I love a good play on words. But let me say a good word on plays. My plays, collected in a lovely book called Marriage, Babies, and the End of the World. Comedies that range from strange to deranged, from sad to satirical, fun to read, and unmistakably Dave. Just $20 hardcover, $12 soft. Put down that crappy bestseller and pick up some laughs. 516-295-1511 or davesgoneby.com. Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on AM 1240 WGBB in Freeport, New York, and live streaming on the web at am1240wgbb.com. And I'm here with the author of A Very Good Year, which is a book about what most of us would consider a really terrible year, because a lot of bad things were happening, although by the end of the year, things kind of got better, but in a strange, odd way. The author of the book is Larry Quachi, C-U-O-C-C-I. Remember that name because you'll be going to Amazon.com and looking for it to buy this book, or just go under the title A Very Good Year, and I think we're going to have a very good interview with Mr. Quachi, who's here in the neighborhood. Welcome, Larry.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going great, going great. So this book, which people would be interested in for two reasons. First of all, the whole issue of what was going on when you were 17 years old and what was happening with your family and specifically your mom, and then also the fact that it was happening around here in like the Brooklyn, Queens, Long Island area. So you're also a local boy. So let's go there. What's the book about?
Well, when I was it takes place when I'm 17 years old, and like most 17-year-olds, I just wanted to have fun, pass my road test, fall in love, get a car, get a girlfriend, but and I was a senior in high school. But my mom was very ill. She was stricken with a deadly form of skin cancer. And as she got worse, she turned to me and she asked me to end her life. And what do you do when somebody you love is in pain and they ask you to end it for them? And it wasn't the kind of thing any of my 17-year-old friends were dealing with. And here, you know, I'm a senior in high school and have these other goals for me and for myself, and have to face this sort of dilemma.
Right. Now, I'm kind of wondering, it's not like she was a single mom raising you. I mean,
no.
You had a dad, and we're going to get into talking about him. But wouldn't it have been more natural for her to ask him to do the euthanasia thing?
Well, my dad was a real son of a bitch. He was an abusive father growing up, and in one of life's great ironies, even though he used to kick the crap out of me back then, now he's 83 years old, and he lives with me and my wife, my son, and my dog, Max, so I'm his caregiver now. And
well, that's
took a lot of forgiveness on my part.
tell what he did to your sister, not just
you. Yeah, I mean, part of this book is about the choices and the stuff I did and at 17 and 1976. But there's also some child abuse there, because, there's a scene there where I relate where my dad chased my sister downstairs to the basement, and she was 7 years older, 7 years older than me, and so she was 12, I was 5. And I watched as my dad upended my sister, held her by her ankles, and proceeded to pound her head into the basement floor. And that was
sounds reasonable.
Vivid imprinting on me.
Probably imprinted the tile on her head.
That's right. Of course, my sister says, I don't remember that. I said, yeah, you know,
she
got brain damage from that. So my
was
dad
she
used to,
I mean,
she was, but she'd gotten beaten. And then when she turned 17, my dad threw her out of the house. So my sister wasn't around when my mom was really ill. And my dad just, he was in denial with my mom's illness, and I was sort of my mom's best friend. We'd go traveling together, we'd go to Broadway shows, opera together, and
While she had the malignant
It certainly cut down the last couple of years. I mean, she wound up fighting cancer all of 5 years, which made her sort of a success story, because she had made the 5-year survival rate. I mean, after she'd had chemotherapy, radiation, all these things, and surgeries, because she had, her body was covered with all these tumors, one the size of a grapefruit, which my father called the cantaloupe. So it was, and then after the surgeries to remove, she thought it would improve her appearance and her quality of life, but after the tumors were removed, she had all these sort of sores all over that I wound up sort of being her nurse and changing her bandages, which was a lot of fun, especially, you know, summer between when I graduated high school and about to start college. So all my friends were having fun in the street, and here was I changing my mom's bandages.
Well, you had a certain way of coping with all this.
Yeah,
your coping mechanism wasn't the best, but...
No, I wound up doing copious amounts of drugs that year. I mean, mostly to escape from my mom's disease. And
your dad's
and my dad's abusive personality. Yeah, he was also verbally abusive. So
I understand that.
On the first page of my book, I just I have a little list of what I did that year. So if I may,
this is A Very Good Year by Larry Quachi, and these are the drugs Larry did when he was 17.
This is on the first page from Chapter 1, The Little Savior. What I remember most about that year was my preoccupation with the 3 Ds, drugs, death, and driving. Drugs. By the time I turned 18, I had inhaled whippets of nitrous oxide, smoked grass, hash, and angel dust. Dropped acid, taken peyote, mescaline, THC, lewds, Demerol, black beauties, and crystal meth. Death. My mom was dying of malignant melanoma, the form of skin cancer where tumors the size of grapefruits erupted all over the surface of her body. In 1976, it was 95% fatal. Now it's only 90% fatal. Ah, the marvels of modern medicine. Driving. From my 17th birthday until my 18th, I failed the driving test 4 times. Not the written. You'd have to be a total moron to fail that even once. No, no. The driving exam itself, you know, hand signals, parallel parking. My dad taught me how to drive. He never let me go over 20 miles per hour while he was in the car. All my driving examiners thought I was too scared to drive, and they were right. But it wasn't driving I was scared of. It was my dad.
And again, the irony being...
Now I take care of him.
You take care of him, and you know there's even a double irony on top of that that goes back on him. What did he want for his birthday?
That's funny. His 83rd birthday.
Yeah.
My dad's got all these diseases. He's got chronic leukemia, scleroderma, congestive heart failure. So he said, Lawrence, for my birthday, no, give me a gift. I want you to make a list on the computer of all my diseases. I said, what do you mean all your diseases? Write a list. Do for me. Write a list. Print it out on the computer. I said, are you sure, Dad? Yeah, this is what I want. So I wrote a list of like 35 ailments that he had, okay? And from the morning of his birthday, he called up all his friends and relatives and he said, you want to hear all my list of diseases? They said, no, thank you, Sergio. Number 1, chronic leukemia. Number 2, scleroderma. And he'd read down the list, and that's how he passed his birthday.
Does he understand that it's karma at this point?
I don't think he... is that? He's a kvetchy old man. I mean, I love him. I had to work very hard to have a loving relationship. In fact, a funny thing, just a couple of years ago, my sister had moved. I mean, we're on good terms, but my sister had moved to Florida a few years ago. And my dad was 81, still driving his car. And I said, Dad, how many miles a year do you drive? And he says, 75. I said, this is before he moved in with us. Yeah. I said, 7,500? No, 75. I said, well, it doesn't pay for you to really keep the car. I mean, I'll give you a lift, and the neighbor will give you a lift. And he says, okay, we give the car to Connie, to your sister, my daughter. I said, okay. And he says, and we drive down to Florida and give it to her. I said, a road trip with me and you? He says, yeah. I said, okay. So we drove down to Florida. We stayed overnight at South of the Border, which we used to. We used to go down to Florida every year when I was a kid, when he'd drive. And all the way going down there, because my dad had never been to Disney World in his life. Because when we used to go to Florida, Disney World hadn't been built yet. And so I'm thinking, I'm going to get my father on the Dumbo ride. I could just see my father spinning around on Dumbo, and I got some great shots of him. And we drove down to Florida, had a road trip, me and my dad. It was a lot of fun. He got to see his sister who lives in Florida. He hadn't seen for 10 years or so. And it was a lot of fun, actually.
Oh, my gosh. There are, I guess, happy endings to things. But let's backtrack to what is the crux story-wise of the book. Of your mom and the decision that she gave to you.
Right.
Because we were up to that point where she labeled it on you
right.
rather than your dad, and then you were spaced with it.
Right. I don't know if anybody out there can recall an actual moment in their life when their childhood was lost and gone forever, but it happened to me. It was July 4th, 1976. It was a bicentennial year. We had, like, Operation Sail, and my friends were lighting bottle rockets outside, and because I had agreed to do this, and my mom's insurance didn't cover a nurse coming in and changing her bandages, so I wound up changing her bandages, and her quality of life after this last surgery had really fallen, and she turned to me and she said, Lawrence, I want you to promise me something. Promise me that if I ever become a vegetable, you'll put a pillow over my head and end it for me. I can't ask this of your father. I could only ask it of you, because I know you do it. Promise me you do it. And I looked out the window. I saw kids. This is July 4th, 76. My friend lighting bottle rockets off, kids popping wheelies on their bikes, girls sunning themselves with reflectors. And I thought, this is the end of my childhood. And literally, I ran screaming from the room. I ran, this was in Canarsie section of Brooklyn, and we were, I guess, about a mile from the water, and I ran to the water, to the Jamaica Bay, and I screamed at God, why me? I mean, the Nancy Kerrigan defense, why me? And I wound up going back to the room, and I told my mom, I promise, Mom, I promise. And then a few months later, she had... the disease had progressed, and she'd slipped into a coma. She was in the hospital, and the doctor said she can't feel or hear or sense the world around her. But I discovered the first day she was in the hospital, I asked her a question. I said, Mom, if you can hear me, wiggle your right forefinger once for yes, twice for no. And I said, can you hear me? She said, yes. And I did tests. You know, is my name Sergio? And she'd say no. So are you in pain? And she said, yes. And then I asked her, do you want me to end it for you? And she said, yes. And that's when I was faced with not just an academic situation, but a real hardcore decision. You know, how do you kill your mom? She was in pain. I wanted the pain to end. I asked the doctors. I said, my mom's in pain. They said, oh, no, she's not. I said, no, she is. And they said, well, here we've got the comatologist on your mom's team, and he says that she's not aware of anything. I said, she's in a lot of pain. I mean, she signaled to me. So they wouldn't even give her pain meds. I asked my friends, my best friend, who was a girl, and I shared all secrets with her, And we're sitting in her room smoking cigarettes, and I turned to her. I said, you know, my mom asked me to end her life, and she's in coma, and she's in pain, and this is what I got to do. And she turns to me. My nickname, which is on the cover of the book, is Cooch. Everybody called me Cooch because nobody from an early age could pronounce Kawachi, so they called me Cooch. And she says, Cooch, I don't know what to say. I can't relate to that. And I felt so unbelievably alone in the world. And I asked doctors hypothetically, and they said, oh, you're talking about euthanasia. We can never harm. We can only heal. And at that point, my mom wasn't doing much healing, so I didn't see their point.
Where did the 7 days come from that you gave yourself like a
Yeah. Break? Oh, so she was in coma, and that night, around the corner from the hospital where she was in the Upper East Side of Manhattan, was this beautiful little church, and I wasn't a religious person. I was brought up, my mom was Jewish, my father was Catholic, and I was Jewish from the waist down. So we had a little tinfoil Christmas tree every Christmas. That was my whole really religious upbringing. But I didn't know where to turn. So, and a teacher, mentor teacher of mine said, you know, how do you feel? Are you religious? Do you believe in God? And I said, I think so. And then also, ironically, my real pothead friend, who was never straight in more ways than one, a day in his life, I called him up. He was at SUNY Binghamton, and he said, well, man, if it was up to me, I'd pray. And this is a guy who I never saw not high, you know.
Right.
I said, you? And he says, yeah, man, I was bar mitzvahed, I believe. And so I prayed to God. And I said, God, I'll give you 1 week, 7 days. If you can take my mom away and make her free from pain and suffering, then do it. If you can't, at the end of the 7 days, I'll have to do it myself. And I went so far as to, you know, timing the nurse's shifts, figuring out a side entrance I could sneak into. I wrapped a pillow with a plastic bag, a dry cleaning bag, because I was afraid, like watching a lot of crime TV, that there'd be an autopsy and there'd be little fibers in the lungs. And I was all ready to do it. And
then the seventh day?
On the seventh day, I was going to Brooklyn College at that time, and we had this road rally, which is like a scavenger hunt where you drive around picking up hints and clues all over the metropolitan New York metropolitan area. And around 1 o'clock in the morning, I was passing her hospital where my mom was on the FDR Drive, and I could swear I heard my mom singing. And she was singing this Mexican folk song she used to sing. As she was a kindergarten teacher for 25 years, and she was singing Cielito Lindo, which is ay, 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 canta no llores. And I could swear I heard her singing. And
it wasn't the Frito Bandito.
It wasn't the Frito Bandito, right. That was
so that was her spirit.
And the next morning, which was the morning of the eighth day, I got a phone call from the hospital that she had passed in her sleep around 1 o'clock in the morning. And I felt that was her spirit that passed me. And it was now the morning of the eighth day, and I was spared my task. I sort of dodged the bullet. And God came through for me.
Could you have done it?
I think I could have done it, but I think I could not have lived with myself. I don't think I could have lived killing the person I love most in my life. That year, which I wound up calling a very good year after the song When I Was 17, it was a very good year, which Frank Sinatra sings and Irvin Drake wrote. During that year, I had a few wishes: to pass my road test, to lose my virginity, and for my mom to be free from pain and suffering. And although I did fall in love for the first time in that year, I got 2 out of 3.
All right.
So it wound up being a very good year for me. And as Nietzsche says, that which does not kill us makes us stronger. And I was stronger. I mean, I learned about love and life and death along the way. And if I didn't have those experiences molded me and made me the person I am today. And the two reasons I really wrote this book was for me to be free from these ghosts. If you keep writing and telling a story over and over, it doesn't have power over you anymore. And also, for people out there who may have had a really hard time in their life or facing tough time, and they don't know if they could get through another day, let alone a week or 7 days. And, I mean, I went through a lot of drugs. I got arrested during this year. I mean, my mom had to come literally bail me out, which was not a fun thing to experience. And fell in love, had my first sexual experience. And the type of ways I dealt with it and how I came out okay and a loving, caring person at the end. I'm happily married and a father.
And you're not smashing your children's heads?
No, I'm not smashing my son's head, although, you know, he's taking jiu-jitsu, so I can't smash his head. He's 21 now. And I take care of my dad, so I'm a pretty good loving son, I hope, knock on wood. And anybody out there who's either disappointed somebody in their life and who hasn't, or just have a tough time, or even has faced child abuse and don't know how they can recover from that, it's all in there. It's all in A Very Good Year. There's sex, drugs, love, death, child abuse. Everything a good story should have.
And if you want to have this story, again, it's called A Very Good Year. It's from Palette Press Books and written by Larry Quacci, Quocci. It was an award finalist at the USBookNews.com for 2004. You can get it at Amazon. You can get it in a bunch of different normal and abnormal book places.
Yes, and April 13th at the Barnes & Nobles on Miracle Mile near Lord & Taylor at 1542 Northern Boulevard. April 13th at 7:30, I'll be doing a reading. Come one, come all. Be there, be square.
Right.
It's a pleasure being here.
Thank you, Larry, for being in the neighborhood.
I hate my family. The holidays came and went, and I didn't get a satellite radio.
Oh, who cares? You've got more than enough cool radio to listen to on WGBB.
Well, sure. There's Dave's Gone By, Thursday nights at 7, but what else?
Shh, calm down. Right after Dave, there's the instrumental invasion of smooth jazz, hosted by Mike Shimeri at 8, and then Dave comes back at 9 on Thursdays with Filler Up.
Well, that's okay.
Of course it's okay. Plus, you've got radio psychic Joyce Keller doing her thing Wednesday nights at 11.
Oh, man, she's been on for years.
That's right. And you can listen to another WGBB veteran, Bonnie D. Graham, talking about the single life on Long Island's Dating Friday nights at 6.
What about comedy? I like comedy.
How about Mikey and Jimmy? Comedy, hard rock music, and live bands in the studio, Saturdays at 5:30. And you can also get a few laughs about serious topics like news and politics on Your World with Joe Salzone, Sunday nights at 7.
Let me get this straight. Joyce Keller, the psychic, Wednesday nights at 11, Mikey and Jimmy the funny, Saturday nights at 5:30.
That's right.
Fridays at 6 is Long Island's Dating. You think Bonnie can hook me up?
No.
Sunday the 7th is Joe Salzone. Thursday night it's you at 7. Mike Shimeri at 8. And you again at 9. Did I get it all?
Nice job.
I don't need a satellite at all.
That's right.
That's good. I read somewhere the ultraphonic waves would interfere with the space aliens in my head.
Why do they always come to me?
Shalom, goddammit! Happy Purim, Shalom! A most happy and joyous Purim holiday to all of you! It is the happiest holiday on the Jewish calendar. And let's face it, we don't have many of them. What do we have? Rosh Hashanah? Supposed to be a happy new year. But usually, the old year is so fraught with troubles and ailments and yard sites and tax problems and back problems, we're too exhausted to even have a good time. And it's not like Rosh Hashanah is as cool as the American New Year. We don't get poop-faced and stand out in the middle of Times Square all night long. Actually, we could get a bunch of yidlach and a mitzvah man with two cases of kedem, stand by the discount theater booth, and hand everybody a piece of apple. Well, now it's too cold, and we just get bumped into by all these putzes running with half-price tickets to see Good Vibrations. No, Rosh Hashanah is not all it's cracked up to be. And Passover? Are you kidding?
8 days of constipation. Everybody wonders. They see me the 6th, the 7th day of Passover, and I'm hunched over like a midget who's been kicked in the basin. I'm so backed up, it's like the road to Woodstock in my small intestine. But the day after Pesach, I have one sandwich and the floodgates. It's like Moshe Rabbeinu waves his stick over my colon, and out comes 8 days worth of dead Egyptians. Or at least that's what it smells like. Anyway, Passover isn't all it's cracked up to be. Even Hashem says so. It's a happy holiday, but not that happy. That's why we spill the wine, we dip the pinky for the 10 plagues, but we're not supposed to rejoice at the death and destruction of our enemy. As if. But tradition dictates we recall with sorrow the thousands of firstborn Egyptians who got washed away faster than Indonesian tourists in an oceanfront cabana. So, between the diet and the sorrow and the seders, Pesach is more work than pleasure, more convoluted than relaxing. Sounds like my sex life. But you know, what other happy holidays are there? Sukkot, that's all right. 45 degrees out, you're eating dinner in a hut. You can't put down a cup of fruit juice, because 10 seconds later they're building a beehive on it. And what? You get to shake a palm frond and hold a lemon. Oh boy, that's some kind of fun, eh? Forget Fantasy Island, forget MTV Spring Break, 500 Jews in long coats and black hats waving fruit at each other. That's frolic, that's revelry. Oh, someone call the cops, it's 2 a.m. and there's a guy tearing at the nipple on his hedgehog. What's the world coming to? But where the hell was I? Oh yeah, Purim. See, those are the happy holidays, the Yom Tovs. Chanukah, there's a happy one. Presents is nice. Singing songs, stuffing our punims with latkes and applesauce. No complaints about Chanukah. That is a happy, good time. It's not Christmas. But then again, we don't have to go through 40 days of Lent. Which is odd, because traditionally we're the ones doing the lending. But Purim is an even happier holiday than Chanukah, because Chanukah was about winning one battle. Purim was about saving the entire Jewish race. Now, the king of Persia was married, little did he know, to a nice Jewish girl named Esther. And the king loved Esther very much. A lot more than he loved his first wife, whom he loved just enough to kill when he got tired of her. So Esther had to stay on her guard, especially when a big macha at the court, a bastard named Haman, decided to make trouble. You see, Esther's uncle, Mordechai, refused to bow down to Haman. Mordechai said, "Look, there's only two people I bend for, God and my proctologist. And at least when I bend for God, he doesn't squeeze my prostate for 20 minutes. Now this enraged Haman, who hated proctologists. They were his natural enemy, since, of course, he was a rotten a-hole. So he started telling the king all these lies about the Jews, like Mordechai. Terrible things, like they owned all the money, they were plotting a revolt, they were obnoxious in restaurants. All right, some were lies, some... But anyway, King Ahasuerus believed Haman and put out a decree that all Jews should be killed. Mordechai went berserk, tearing his clothes, rending his garments, buying a one-way ticket to Canada, and he was especially upset because he once saved the king's life. He foiled an assassination attempt. And this was the monarch's thank you? Killing all the Jews? Son of a bitch. But Esther kept her pretty little head about her, and she told Mordechai, she said, "Don't worry. Don't be happy. Just pray. And then come to the big banquet next week." Well, it was a fabulous party. Terrific food, a creative DJ, and the king was having a great time. And Esther pointed out Mordechai in the crowd and said, "You see that guy? That guy with a coleslaw on his shirt? He's wiping it off, but that only makes it worse." And the king says, "Right, he looks familiar. Did he install my cable?" And Esther says, No. He did you one better. He saved your life. And you know what else?" "What?" said the king. "He's Jewish. Look at the hat. Look at the robe. Look at the beard. Look at the big letter J on his T-shirt." "I thought that stood for Jordash," said the king. It does, Your Highness, but who else wears that crap? Oh, my God, said the king, he's a Jew. That's right, said Esther, and I am one, too. No, King Ahasuerus gasped. Funny, you don't look it. But Esther proved to him she was Jewish by nagging him incessantly, refusing to cook dinner, and telling him that oral sex was out of the question except once a year on his birthday. Oh, how blind I have been, said the king. Here I was, about to have all the Jews exterminated, and the person who have suffered the most was me. And then the king looked around the court and said, now, who put these ideas in my head that Jews are evil and out to ruin everything, besides Mel Gibson? Now, Queen Esther, trying to be helpful, pointed to the one and only Haman and said, there he is. There's the man who tried to destroy my people. And before Haman could sneak off to South America for diplomatic immunity, he was hanged, with Mordechai becoming prime minister with a special directive to allow Jews to defend themselves. And the king and Esther lived happily ever after, as did all the Jews in the region. Not an easy thing to do when you're a Yid stuck in the middle of Iran. But that's why we dance around and dress in costumes and get drunk on Purim. We're happy to be alive because we came so close to the reverse. Hey, imagine if we had gotten that lucky with Hitler. Let's say it was 1931, and von Hindenburg is married to Fanny Bryce, and she convinces him that the funny little painter with a mustache is a traitor, and all his drinking buddies are actually terrorists plotting to fly a plane into the Reichstag. Snip, snap, Hitler gets beaten to death and tossed in the Danube. But such are the whims of fate that we were saved 1,000 years ago to be tortured 60 years ago. However, we survive, which again is the miracle of this happy holiday, Purim. On Purim, the Talmud says, and this is not a joke, the Talmud says, you're supposed to drink so much, you can't tell the difference between a cursed Haman and a blessed Mordechai. You're supposed to consume so much alcohol, your enemy will no longer be the Palestinians, but confused British Protestants. Rava, the Talmudist, put it this way. You're supposed to drink sufficiently to be fragrant with alcohol. Not flagrant, that comes later, but fragrant. You stink of Stoli. You reek of Riesling. And this is a very wise Talmudist, because he is saying, drink just enough, so everyone around you knows you're shicker, and they won't let you get in a car, and they won't let you stumble home and hurt yourself. And also, if you're going to have 5 or 6 prune hamantaschen, and then drink a quart of Jack Daniels, the next day you are going to be cleaning some carpet. Speaking of which, what is the deal with this chocolate-covered hamantaschen? Have you seen this? Suddenly they're dipping these little pastries in dark chocolate. When did this happen? When I was growing up, there were 2 kinds of hamantash, little triangular pastries made of dough with a fruit center. You had prune, which was traditional, and mooin, which was disgusting. No, it was prune and mooin. Poppy seeds was the other. And then, a few years later, they introduced apricot. Nobody asked them to. Nobody liked it. Nobody wanted it. But there was an apricot surplus that year, and let's face it, considering the taste, I'm surprised there isn't an apricot surplus every year. And that was that, until very recently. And now, there's cherry, and raspberry, and fig, and date, and chocolate. Now, I admit, you cannot go wrong with chocolate. Chocolate is a delicious thing. If there wasn't milk in it, I would pour, you bet, on a prime rib. But I think we're getting away from tradition a little when a hamantash has a Hershey center. After all, don't forget the original derivation of the hamantash pastry. It's got the name Haman in it, and it's shaped, so legend goes, like Haman's hat. We eat his triangular chapeau. I guess to show that not only did King Ahasuerus do away with his body, but we are demolishing his belongings even down to his 3-cornered hat. Of course, that is also the story we tell the kiddies.
Remember that Purim is also a spring holiday. Planting and pruning and budding, fecundity and procreativity. In other words, it's a sex snack, for Christ's sake. Look at it, the triangle, the sticky goo in the middle. What other thing is shaped like a triangle that men will only eat when they're forced to? Makes you wonder why they started with prune and not cherry. And the legend goes, when you put your tongue in the center of a hamantash, somewhere in heaven, Queen Esther has an orgasm. Or at least she fakes it. But what's with the chocolate? Dipping the thing in chocolate noch. Don't be doing kinky homosexual things with hamantash. Save that for the Passover lollycones. But otherwise, don't make the most of Purim. Jews know all we need to know about suffering. We have been miserable and tormented for 5,000 years. So, when we get a day that calls for the opposite of anguish, the flip side of woe, for heaven's sake, take it and run with it. Eat the food, drink the drink, read the Megillah, give candy and presents to your neighbors, especially if I happen to be your neighbor. Damn it, I'm starving! Please send your care packages to Rabbi Saul Solomon, care of Dave's Gone By, Fox 62 in Hewlett. If it's perishable, use FedEx. It's in the Mishnah. Rabbi Gamliel said in 1532, if spoilage is an issue, use Federal Express. I don't know how he knew, but that's why they were prophets, goddammit! Anywho, I see by the old grogger on the wall that it's time for me to make like a Haman and Tosh. I wish you all an exultant and jubilant Purim holiday. Drink until you don't know the difference between Fox and CNN. Between Jessica Simpson and Grandpa Simpson. Between Dave's Gone By and Filler Up. Now that is an in-joke because I'll be on Filler Up later tonight also. Drink until you can't tell the difference between fried rice, basmati rice, and Condoleezza rice. Between Law and Order Criminal Intent and Law and Order Special Victims Unit. Wait. I must be drunk already, because I can't tell a damn difference between those two. But anyway, on behalf of myself, my dear wife Miriam Libby, and our 18 and a half children, Nehemiah, Josiah, Shlomi, Chana, Rivki, Yehuda, Moish, Yechezkel, Boruch, Avigdor, Yisrael, Hepzibah, Shaul, Aliza, Shimon, Gedalia, Naphtali, and Fred, by my first marriage, and the fetus, Beryl, who should be crowning any day now. I crown you all the kings and queens of your holiday dreams. Purim Sameach from every one of me to every one of you. What do the letters DFSX stand for? They stand for Dave's Gone By, that's what, because DFSXRadio.com is rebroadcasting vintage episodes of Dave's Gone By every Thursday night at 8 and 11 Eastern Time. So you hear me on GBV and then listen to me on DFSXRadio.com every Thursday night at 8 and 11. It's all the Dave you could ever want. Kinda.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on this Purim night, 2005. I want to thank my special guest, Rabbi Saul Solomon, for giving us such an engrossing and scholarly and angry explanation of the holiday. Thanks also to author Larry Quachi. Look for his book, A Very Good Year, on Amazon and other major booksellers. If you grew up on Long Island or if you have a relative who may be in a similar situation to what Larry went through with his family, it's definitely a book you want to get. A Very Good Year from Palette Press. And if you're in a book-buying mood, why not buy a copy of my own little volume, Marriage, Babies, and the End of the World, on sale at my website, davesgoneby.com. It's a book of one-act and full-length comedies. People seem to like them. Maybe you will, too. And if you like this show, or specifically this episode of Dave's Gone By, you can get it complete on CD. Just $14, including a jewel case, track listings, and nice cover. Again, davesgoneby.com is the place to go for CDs of nearly every show we've ever done. They're all $14, including postage and handling. If you add a dollar, I'll personally autograph the cover. Before I go, I want to remind you that at 9 on WGBB, after Mike Shamari's instrumental invasion of smooth jazz, is a show called Filler Up, an hour of eclectic music that I usually host, but this week owing to the holiday, Rabbi Saul Solomon will return, and he'll be playing a mix of Jewish music and comedy to kick off Purim in high style. That's tonight at 9. And also, you can hear another episode of Days Gone By, starting right now, and repeating it at 11 p.m. Eastern on DFSXRadio.com. The link is on DavesGoneBy.com, so just go there, click, and listen. And thank you for listening to this week's episode. Thank you to my loyal sponsors, Hewlett Minuteman Press, for all your copying needs, and Total Theater, publishers of Performing Arts Insider Theater Magazine. Days Gone By listeners get 10% off both copying at Minuteman and subscription for Performing Arts Insider, so do take advantage of these great offers. Next week, March 31st, a return visit by Soda, a musician who was on the show last year, really nice guy, who is part of two different bands. One is a duo called One Last November, and that's what he was pushing when he was here last. Next Thursday, he's back with his other group, His Mighty Robot. They've just released a 4-song EP, so we're going to give it a listen and talk to the band members. Should be a lot of fun. Last but most, I can't end this very good show without a kiss for my beloved wife, Joyce, a few days before our 7th anniversary. Much as I love theater, much as I love radio, she's the true love of my life, and I'm so lucky to have her. I hope I'll have all of you back next week, 7 p.m., March 31st, for the 121st episode of Days Gone By. Until then, don't miss your days going by. This is Dave Lefkowitz. Good night. Have a good spring, a good Purim, a good Easter, and a good Friday, and gone by.